Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Roberto Mazza, your host and the host of the Jerusalem Unplugged podcast. Today, my guest is Professor Dario Miccoli. Dario is currently Assistant Professor of Modern Hebrew and Jewish Studies at the Department of Asian and North African Studies at Ca' Foscari in Venice, and is the author of A Sephardi Sea, Jewish Memories Across the Modern Mediterranean, which has been published by Indiana University Press in 2022 and is available paperback, hardcover, and ebook edition. The book is very much a story of Jews from the southern shore of the Mediterranean who, between the late 1940s up to the 1950s and late into the mid-1960s, migrated from their country of origin to Europe, Israel, and beyond. First of all, Dario, welcome.
Thank you, Roberto.
Dario, my first question is very much about yourself. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and the origins of the book?
Sure. Well, I should say that I have a background in Middle Eastern studies and languages, Hebrew and Arabic, and then I completed a PhD in history that was dedicated to the Jews of modern Egypt in the first half of the 20th century. And so I would say a little bit in between the field of Middle Eastern studies, broadly speaking, Jewish studies and history, on the other hand. And so the book that I've now published, A Sephardi Sea, is in a way a mixture of all these different disciplines that I mentioned, because it's not exactly a historical monograph. It's not a book that discusses just literature and literary sources. It's not an anthropological study, but in a way is a little bit of all these things together. And the origin of the book is, in fact, at the beginning, it was, in a sense, a way to continue what I had started with my previous research, that is, as I mentioned, was on the Jews of Egypt. But for that and for the book that then I published on that subject, I had stopped around the 1950s, so when the Jews left, in that case, Egypt. With A Sephardi Sea, I start from the 50s and 60s, and I arrive more or less to the contemporary age, and also expanding not just the Jews of Egypt, but expanding the area of interest to the entire southern shore of the Mediterranean, so Egypt and North Africa in particular. It was, as I said, a way to look at the history and memory of the Jews of the Arab world in a more contemporary sense, and not just by focusing on historical sources.
You're right saying that this is not a monograph dedicated to the history of Sephardi Jews. And in fact, this is a book about migrations, memoirs, and cultural heritage. And so as you mentioned just now, can you tell us a little bit more about your methodological approach and the sources that you have used for your book? And also, I was very curious about concepts, actually two, that you use at the very beginning of a book, space and memory. What do they mean for you and how important these are for the book?
Yes, in terms of sources, as I said, I've tried to combine different kinds of sources. For example, historical documents taken from various archives in Israel and also in other countries, together with literary sources, so memoirs, autobiographies, as you said, novels written, especially, I would say, over the last 20, 25 years by Jews from North Africa and Egypt in different languages, mainly Hebrew, French, and Italian. And then I also try to add some oral interviews that I conducted with members of these communities, again, in these three countries, Italy, France, and Israel. And lastly, also what can be called perhaps a sort of a participant observation, meaning that I took part in the activities of migrant associations or visited exhibitions and museums that dedicated to these communities and analyzed what I found in these places in a sort of ethnographic way. And so for this reason, the methodological approach is a multidisciplinary one that tries to combine all these things together. And I think that this is perhaps why, at least when I think about this book, I think it's difficult to put it in precisely in one disciplinary field. Perhaps I would say it is a research that wants to be in the field of Jewish studies, intended in a very broad sense, that takes advantage of literary studies methodology as well as more historical and historiographic approaches and again ethnography. As for space and memory, of course, these are two very important aspects and two very important categories that I utilize in the book. Already in the title, we find a geographical reference to the Mediterranean. And also in terms of space, the subtitle is Jewish Memories Across the Mediterranean. This Mediterranean space that I focus on is a space that extends both north and south of both in Europe and in the Middle East and North Africa, I think it was important also to connect that to memory, not just because as we know, memory has become very much a crucial category in the last decades in the academia, but also for public opinion, if more broadly. And I think in Jewish history, Jewish studies in particular, memory, of course, has always been very, very relevant. But again, in the last years, it's become more and more central, and more publications have been published on this subject, and so space and memory surely are two of the central categories that I focus on. And if I can add just one last thing, perhaps about space and this Mediterranean space, although perhaps we can then also go back to that later. It is a geographical space, so I utilize the category of space in a geographical sense, but also, and perhaps even more, in a cultural and imaginative sense. And this is something that I also did with my previous work on the Jews of Egypt and on their cultural and social imaginary.
I want to ask you a couple of questions together about terminology. First of all, in the beginning of the book, you use the expression Sephardi Mediterranean. And I was wondering if you can tell us what you mean by that. And perhaps you can also tell us a little bit more for those that might not be very familiar with the categories of Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews, which often have been combined together, but Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews are not necessarily the same.
Yes. Well, for Sephardi Mediterranean is, with this expression, I identify these geocultural space, perhaps I should say, where the Jews of North Africa and the Middle East lived, and a space that from a purely historical point of view has largely or almost entirely vanished when the Jews of the region moved to Israel and to other places in the 50s and 60s. But at the same time, the Sephardi Mediterranean is also a very much persistent space that continues to exist in the mind of the migrants and of the generations, of the second and third generation after the migration. And so, and also it is a category that again connects the two shores of the Mediterranean, because this Sephardi Mediterranean is North Africa, Egypt, or the Levant, but is also Italy, France, and of course Israel, all the places and countries where these Jews happened to live and where they live today. And Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews, so in the first category, Sephardi, if we take it in the literal sense, in the literal meaning of the word, refers to what in Hebrew is Sepharad, that is more or less the Iberian Peninsula, so Spain and Portugal of today, and from where the Jews were expelled in the 15th century and moving to various places such as North Africa, but also Italy, the Netherlands, and so on. So the literal sense of Sephardi is a Jew of Iberian origin. Then if we take it in a less specific way, and this is also how I utilize it in the book, Sephardi nowadays, especially in English, but also in languages such as French, indicates a Jew from the Middle East and North Africa. So as it is the opposite of Ashkenazi, intending by Ashkenazi a Jew from Europe. Although, as I said, literally speaking, it is not 100% correct, but still it's become very much common and popular also in the academic discussion, I would say. And this is also why I utilize it as such. Mizrahi is a Hebrew word. So Mizrahi in Hebrew just means east. Mizrahi means oriental, easterner, and indicates, again, a Jew from the Arab world, or more broadly, from the Middle East and North Africa, in Israel today. It's a category that has a long and complex history. Initially, it was quite a negative and derogatory term in the 60s and 70s, but then from the 80s, it's become more and more common also as a mean of self-identification by Israelis of Middle Eastern and North African origin, as to call themselves as Mizrahim. So in the book, I utilize both categories, the Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews, in two different ways. By Sephardi, I mean a Jew from North Africa and Egypt that in the 50s and 60s moved to Europe or for example, also to the US. But in the book, I focus, as I said, on Italy and France. And on the other hand, with Mizrahi, I indicate the Jew from North Africa and Egypt that moved to Israel. So I utilize these two terms. And just one last thing to conclude this terminological discussion, because there's no term that includes all these Jews together. It's very difficult. It's impossible to find just one category that identifies everything. We have to utilize long expressions like Jews of the Middle East and North Africa. So I had to accommodate and find a solution to that. And I know already some colleagues have told me that they do not agree 100% with my choice, but and that's fine. But as I said, I had to find a solution to that, and I think this seemed to me quite a practical one, and also a solution that was not too difficult for readers to understand.
Let me say that I may understand the criticism, but in fact I also understand the necessity to be pragmatic and allow the readers to get a sense about who are these people, their background, and at some point without being dragged into endless debates about one identity or the other. So I understand from an academic perspective, but I also appreciate the fact that you made a choice, and it's a clear one, and it's also explained very clearly. So I think that helps the readers of the book. Let me go to chapter one. So chapter one takes us into the question of literary memoirs and memories. And I want to ask about the Italian-Libyan experience of being exiled, very much because we are both Italians, and also because I want to add that, for those who are interested, in the current edition of MasterChef Israel, one of the participants is an Italian-Libyan Jew. His name is Amos. And he's a very fascinating figure because he's actually bringing to the Israeli public his identity as Italian-Libyan, combined together, and also he brought several times throughout the show his experience as an exile, what he brought with him. And I thought it was a fitting image of this chapter. So can you tell us a little bit more about the exiled experience?
Yes. Well, if we take the case of the Jews of Libya, first of all, we should say that the case, or the Libyan Jewish case, is perhaps one of the least known among the Jews of North Africa. On one hand, it is understandable because it was one of the smallest communities. So compared to the Moroccan, we can understand why perhaps there has been less interest or less research on this community. But I think the demographic explanation is just one side of that. I think the most significant factor that led to this less consideration of the Jews of Libya compared to others also depended on the fact that the Jews of Libya lived under Italian colonialism, which is in itself very much unknown even in Italy until today. And if we look at the history of the Jews of Libya through the centuries, the Jews were a rather small community, but still one that was very much part of local societies in Tripolitania, in Cyrenaica, in cities like Tripoli, Benghazi. And the Italian colonialism, of course, led at least partially to a kind of Italianization of Libyan Jewish society. And then we arrive at the years where more or less my interest in this community starts, that are the final years of the Jews of Libya in Libya, and then their migration from the country. And as regards the migration from Libya, we have two great migratory waves that occur in different periods. The first one, that was also the largest one, occurred around 1948. In that case, we see the majority of this migration going to the state of Israel. Only a very small part to Italy. Then there was a second migration that occurred around 1967. And in that case, we see a much larger number of Libyan Jews also moving to Italy. So the first migration, as I said, 1948, so during the Palestine War, whereas the second one, 1967, occurred at the time of the Six Days War. And then in the period that followed the Six Days War, between 67 and 69, when there was the coup d'etat of Muammar Gaddafi and the fall of the Libyan monarchy. In the book, I focus, when I talk about the Jews of Libya, I focus in particular about their literary production in Italian. That is very much unknown, at least outside of Italy, but even in Italy, I should say. And I talk about a few memoirs and autobiographies published in Italian over the last years. And then in other sectors of the book, I instead focus on museums and heritage centers by Libyan Jews. And perhaps one of the interesting thing of the Libyan Jewish case is this, the fact that they are a virtually unknown community, especially in the context of the Jews of Italy. Nowadays, a great portion of, for example, the Jews of Rome are of Libyan descent, but still today, the Libyan Jewish experience has not yet become a foundational component of Italian Jewish identity. And in this sense, there's still a lot to do to make this identity more visible and to understand the exiled experience in Italy, especially of this community and the difficulties that they faced when they arrived and the difficult relations that at least many of them had with the Jews of Italy that were a rather different community compared to them.
Can I ask you something just briefly, a quick overview also about the other experience that you talk about in chapter one, which refers to Tunisian and Egyptian Jews?
Yes, there's a lot of differences, but also of similarities between, perhaps especially between the Tunisian and Libyan. And in fact, just to add one thing before starting to answer the question, one of the intriguing things I'd say of looking at all these juries together is seeing the great diversity that they have, although in the end they were living in a relatively small space like North Africa and Egypt, and of course a space that was very much connected. But still, if we look at all these juries individually and even within each of these juries, the Jews of Libya, the Jews of Tunisia, and so on, we see that we have many even sub-communities and sub-groups. So as regards the Jews of Tunisia, for example, first of all, if we look at late 19th and 20th century, Tunisia, of course, was not under Italian colonial rule, but French. So they encountered a different kind of colonialism and of colonial identity. But aside from that, if we go back in history, the Jews of Tunisia were traditionally divided into three big subgroups. The most ancient one were the so-called Tuansa, the autochthonous Jews of let's say real Tunisian and Arab or Arabic speaking community that was located in Tunis as well as in many other cities like Sousse, and many others. Then the second group was instead a kind of elite that mainly lived in the capital, Tunis, And this was called the so-called Qarana, that comes from the Arabic for Livorno, the Tuscan port city of Livorno, where from the early modern period, a very important Sephardi community developed, and then especially from the 18th century, many families of merchants from Livorno started to migrate all over the Mediterranean, and particularly to Tunis. So the Qarana were in a way a kind of more westernized, if we want to use this term, elite that especially from the 19th and then 20th century with the Risorgimento and then with the advent of fascism became closer perhaps to Italy than to France. And then lastly, another one third and last group of Tunisian Jews were the Jews of the island of Djerba, that were another very ancient community that still exists, although in very small numbers today. Still nowadays, for example, the Jews of Djerba and many Jews of Tunisian origin every year perform this pilgrimage to the Ghriba, that is one of the synagogues of Djerba, that is a very important aspect of Tunisian Jewish folklore. So this is for the Jews of Tunisia in general. And another interesting thing of the Jews of Tunisia is, again, compared, for example, to the Libyan, is their migration trajectories. I said before that the Jews of Libya went first to Israel and then mostly to, in total, most of the Jews of Libya ended up in Israel, but then in 67, quite a few also to Italy. In the case of Tunisia, the migration occurred around the 1950s, at the time of the end of the protectorate, and then again in 1967. Most of them went to Israel again, but we also have quite a significant community in France, of course, and less in other places, like, for example, North America, but it's mainly Israel and France. Egypt, which is perhaps it's my favorite, as it's the community on which I wrote my PhD. It's a Jewish community to which I'm particularly attached, I should say. The Jews of Egypt are yet another example of this diversity I was talking about. If we think about the migration trajectories, as I was mentioning, it's different both from the Tunisian and Libyan, because the Egyptians literally dispersed over four or five different countries. A little bit less than half of the community, around 35-40% of the Jews from Egypt went to Israel, but then also many went to France. But not that many went to Great Britain. Then we also have quite significant Egyptian Jewish communities nowadays in the United States, but also, for example, in Australia or in Brazil. And the Egyptian community was made of, on one side, again, an autochthonous community that was actually a very, very small component of the Jews of modern Egypt. The majority of Jews of 20th century Egypt were descended of migrants that had arrived in Egypt only in the fin de siècle, so between the 19th and 20th century, from all over the Mediterranean, but even in some cases from Europe. And this was by and large a middle-class community, by and large an urban community. More than 90% of the Jews of Egypt lived either in Cairo and Alexandria, and very, very few in smaller centers. So just from these three examples, we, again, as I said, see the great diversity of these communities that of course, in many ways mirror the diversity of the region.
Egypt features prominently in Chapter 2, but before talking about Egypt, I want to ask you about the title of Chapter 2, which I found fascinating. Intangible heritages. What do you mean? And what is tangible and what is intangible?
Sure. Well, if we think of the field of heritage studies, and that is the field that in a way invented the categories of tangible and intangible heritage. By tangible heritage, or also, for example, if we take definitions like the definition that UNESCO gives of heritage, that is perhaps one of the most important definitions, although one that has been discussed and critically discussed by some scholars. If we look at all that, tangible heritage means something that we can touch, that we can see, for example, a monument or even a city or a building in a city, or a book, an object, some kind of a piece of art, for example, in the case of the Jews of, Morocco, a Jewish cemetery is in a way an example of tangible heritage, or a synagogue, or the objects inside a synagogue. A Torah scroll is a tangible, can be defined as tangible heritage. Intangible heritage is all that remains outside outside this definition. So memory, in a way, can be defined as a form of intangible heritage, or also a song, or a folklore, a proverb that passes from one generation to the other. Cooking a certain recipe in a specific way is part of intangible heritage, although, of course, when we start eating this particular food, it becomes perhaps tangible. And so this is very, very briefly a way to distinguish between tangible and intangible. But in the book, as you said, I utilize these two categories, but I also utilize a sort of third category that is intangible. So in between brackets, tangible heritage, because when I was looking at these communities, first of all, I realized, as of course other scholars have done, that after the migration, the Jews of North Africa and Egypt, when they arrived in Israel or in Italy or in France, they arrived with very few objects. In some cases, they arrive without anything from their countries of origin. And therefore, in order to reconnect to the land of birth, they had to think of very much intangible aspects, like, as I said, memory or singing a song, reciting a specific prayer in the tune of the Tunisian Jewish liturgy, and so on. And all the synagogues remained where they were. Cemeteries, of course, and tombs cannot be transported in other places. And so it was using these categories of intangible was a way to come to terms with communities of refugees, migrants, that in this case, as in all cases, always find themselves with very little from the country of origin when they move to another place. And this is very interesting also when we look at, for example, today, exhibitions about these communities. A very interesting example that I discuss in the book is an exhibition that was dedicated about 10 years ago to the Jews of Algeria at the Musée du Judaïsme, the Jewish Museum of Paris, and precisely to address the lack of tangible heritage that the Jewish Museum of Paris had about Algeria, the curators, months or a year before the exhibition, launched a public appeal to the Jews of Algeria living in France, asking them to give objects on loan in order to organize this exhibition, as I said, 2012, that was the first major exhibition ever realized in France on the Jews of Algeria. And so many people, for example, gave photographs from their family albums, small objects that they had taken from Algeria, like perhaps a piece of clothing or a book, a diary, and so on. And this was, I think, a very intelligent way to bypass this lack or the scarcity of tangible heritage that these communities have to deal with.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I want to ask you a question about what might be an intangible heritage. There's a very interesting section in part of chapter 2 about the association of Egyptian Jews in Israel. That made me think about the recent book by Hannah Ahmad, which I interview for the network, on Laila Murad, who has become in time an icon for Egyptian Jews in Israel, even though she converted to Islam. But many Egyptian Jews still claim any kind of link to her, whether they met her, knew her, or even to be a relative. Can you give us a sense of the memory of Egypt in Israel?
If we think of the Jews of Egypt that live in Israel, that are not that many compared, for example, to Moroccan Jews or even to Tunisian Jews, perhaps. So if we think of the Egyptian Jewish community in Israel today, the memory of Egypt is, generally speaking, I would say a rather positive one, and this is something that is not entirely unique to this case, to the Egyptian Jewish case, but surely it's a much more joyful memory than what we see if we look at the Jews of Yemen or Libya or even to some extent perhaps Iraq, I would say. And so the Jews of Egypt in Israel today remember Egypt as a cosmopolitan place, as a place where they were living generally a much better and more prosperous life than what they then had to face in Israel, where there was, for many at least in the beginning, a shifting towards from the middle class or upper middle class to lower social strata, which is something that of course occurred also in many other cases, but in the case of the Jews of Egypt was perhaps more evident, precisely because many enjoyed quite a good life in Cairo and Alexandria. So Egypt as a cosmopolitan place where they had friends belonging to different religious communities, Muslims, Copts, Italians, Greeks, where everybody spoke three or four languages, as opposed to Israel, where everybody, especially in the 50s and 60s, only spoke, only spoke, or let's say that where people were required to speak only Hebrew. So the Egypt that they like, in a way, quite understandably perhaps, is the Egypt they remember, and the Egypt of the monarchy and from before Nasser. Then with Nasser, of course, a much more difficult period began. And then when they look then at the Egypt of today, the reflections on it are not so positive, but instead, when they compare the Egypt of today to that they experience, they generally complain about the differences and the negative differences that they see, and the fact that Egypt today is perceived from their point of view as a much less open-minded society, where minority groups do not have the place that they had in the first half of the 20th century. This is, of course, something interesting, because even before the 1950s, Egypt was actually, surely it was a place where many different communities lived together, but again, it was also a place where many social and ethno-religious hierarchies also existed. But here, of course, the perspective is that of people like the Jews of Egypt, and especially the first generation men and women that nowadays are perhaps at least 70 or 80 years old, that experience a rather traumatic experience of migration. And I have myself participated in a few of the annual gathering that Egyptian Jews have generally in Israel, with people from Israel, but also from all over the world. And that they were very moving experiences for me as well, as a researcher, to see how these people remember their youth in Cairo and Alexandria. Of course, from a historiographic point of view, one could start saying that, yes, but this is not true. It was not exactly like that. But I think that in a way, and this is what I've also tried in part to do in the book, I think it is also important to listen to their voices without saying if what they remember is right or wrong, but just listening to what they remember and trying to understand why they remember it that way.
I think in the future there will be the need to look at the question of owning the memory and how memory changes throughout time, but that's for other generations. Even though it connects with my next question, which is about digital diasporas. Now, this is obviously not a new idea, but I was wondering if you can tell us more about how you work with this idea of a digital diasporas, and also how Facebook and perhaps other social media may play a role in preserving heritage and memory.
Digital diaspora, of course, as you mentioned, by now there's quite a lot of research on digital history, digital diasporas, digital studies more generally. So in the book I use the category of digital diaspora with this category I refer to Jews from North Africa and Egypt that interact online, either through websites of migrant and heritage association, online forums or social networks, as you just said, like Facebook primarily. But then when we start to look at their interaction on these different web pages and social media, we see that these digital diasporas is not just made of members of, for example, the Moroccan Jewish diaspora, strictly speaking. But the digital dimension, the online dimension, allows also many other people that do not exactly belong to the Moroccan Jewish community that are not Moroccan Jews to take part in the discussion. So, for example, Moroccan Muslims, anyone who's just perhaps interested that lived in Morocco and wants to say something on that met a Moroccan Jew and remembers something about that. In the case of websites of Moroccan Jews, in the book I analyze in particular, this website that is called Dafina, that is the name of one of the most important dishes of the Moroccan Jewish cuisine. On Dafina, the users are obviously, for the most part, Jews from Morocco, but also, as I said, Moroccan Muslims, Europeans, especially French, that lived in Morocco when Morocco was a French colony. And so the online dimension, in a way, allows for a broadening of these diasporas. And also, on the other hand, it allows perhaps, at least in some ways, the younger generations to take part in the process of heritage and memory making. If we look at heritage associations like the one of the Jews from Egypt that I mentioned before, more than half of the people that take part in their activities, like conferences, annual gathering, are generally members of the first generation. So by now, old people. And so one of the things that we ask ourselves when we notice that is how, what will happen when this first generation will disappear, which is something that is already happening. It's not something that will happen in 50 years. And perhaps the digital dimension could be one of the answers. So online interaction as a way to transmit in new ways this identity, the history and memory of this diaspora. Also, of course, thinking of the fact that nowadays we're always connected in some ways. And so even distinguishing perhaps between digital and between online and offline, like tangible and intangible, will probably become less relevant. No, I mean, it's already become not so relevant for many of us. So I don't think that the internet will be the solution, also because in some cases, internet is a vector of not for more information on these communities, but for the dissemination of wrong information, as we know. But it could be one of the possible solutions to the vanishing of the first generation.
You were saying something about Facebook and how particularly related to the newer generation, and it really made me think that is probably the areas where a lot of historians will look at later in the future, try to gather also how memory has been reshaped through social media, Facebook, Instagram, and all of the others, because then that becomes the point and the place where we can gather and see how that transformation occurred. Obviously, this is not the only place. There's still memory transmitted orally, writings, TV shows, and so forth. But certainly, in terms of like a digital space, that's going to become very, very important for us. I want to move to chapter 3, because there you look at how North African and Egyptian Jewish diasporas have been or not included in the narratives of a country of immigration. And I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about this. Can you elaborate more about, on this idea of being included or not in the narratives?
In the narrative of the country of immigration, again, we have to distinguish between the country where these communities ended up moving. I will start with the case of Israel, that is the most important one in terms of number, and not only in terms of number. So in the case of Israel, if we look at the situation from the 50s and 60s and then move to the current to today, we can notice surely an improvement, I would say, in the acknowledgement of in the public acknowledgement of these communities and in the inclusion of their historical narratives in the national Israeli narrative. Still today, of course, even in Israel, there's still a lot to do. But it is true that over the last 10, 20 years, also quite a lot has been done, even by state institutions. There have been attempts for including the North African and Middle Eastern Jewish past in school curriculum. For example, I'm thinking of the so-called Va'ad Biton. It was a committee headed by the poet Erez Biton. Then there has been in 2014 the establishment of a Memorial Day that I analyze in the book, that every 30th of November commemorates the migration or and expulsion, as it's called in the name of the day, of the Jews from the Middle East and North Africa. Then, of course, we can discuss if the ways in which the Israeli state in this case has included these narratives is historically accurate or not. As I said, we can discuss about that. But in any case, I still think that even though this Memorial Day can be analyzed and looked at different with various angles, we can discuss why it was founded at that particular moment, in why it's always also related to the case of the Palestinians and so on and so forth. But still, I think it's an important step forward for these communities and for becoming more visible on the public sphere. Not to talk, of course, of more popular culture like music, literature, television, where we see the Mizrahim, the Israelis of Middle Eastern and North African Jewish origin, more and more over the last decades. Then, of course, if we move to other locations where the North African Jews moved, like France or Italy, the situation is different. In the case of Italy, is perhaps the one where the North African, mainly Libyan, Jewish experience is less visible. Again, the main reason is, of course, numbers. The Jews of Libya are a relatively small component of the Jews of Rome and Milan in particular. The Jews of Italy altogether are very few. If we compare them to the with the total Italian population, about 30,000 people of Italian Jews in a country of more than 60 million people. And so for this reason, the Libyan and more generally North African experience, Jewish experience in Italy is not very very visible, as I was mentioning. There has been some memoirs and novels published over the last few years, especially by Jews from Libya, but also Jews from Egypt and Tunisia that write in Italian. But still, there's quite a lot to do, even, I would say, within the Jewish community itself. France is perhaps somewhere in between Italy and Israel. The case of France is interesting because it's the country where, in Europe, where the largest number of Middle Eastern, well, of North African, actually, more precisely, Jews lived, especially from the 50s, especially Jews from Algeria, but also Morocco and Tunisia. And there have been a lot of memoirs, books published in French in the last years. Very important exhibitions on these topics. I mentioned already the one on the Jews of Algeria of 2012, but just in 2021-22, there have been two major exhibitions in Paris on the Jews of the Arab world, one at the Institut du Monde Arabe and the other one at the National Museum of Immigration of Paris. So in the case of France, the North African Jewish experience is, I would say, at least in in some ways included in the French Jewish experience. Also, when we think that after the Holocaust, the arrival of North African Jews in France had a very significant demographic impact. So nowadays, now I don't remember the exact figures, but a very large portion of French Jewry is actually of North African, or at least partly of North African origin, as opposed to the case of Italy, where we're talking of a very small, much smaller portion. And of course, if I can add one last thing, it also depends on the inclusion of these narratives in the country of immigration. Also depends, and this is also another thing that I try to address in the book, it depends on how migrants more generally are included in public discussions. In Italy, as we both know, migrants are a relatively recent addition to Italian society, and one that is very much understudied and not very deeply discussed at a public level, if not in very simplistic ways very often. The case of France is a very different one, because of the very different history that that this country had, the impact of the Algerian War, and so on.
And I guess also this connects with the question of how to have a healthy debate about the colonial past, which in Italy never really took place, and it's still at the very margin of both scholarly and certainly public debates. Perhaps other countries had a better experience. So it's already hard to get to touch upon the question of the colonial past, least the question of, in our case, the discussion about the Jewish component of that. I want to ask you something about the Holocaust, because you just mentioned that as we reach the end of our conversation. Now, the historical experience of North African and Egyptian Jews was rather different. Occasionally, it was very similar from European Jews, but in general, certainly Mizrahi experience of the Holocaust is very different. And I was wondering how the narratives of the Holocaust have become part of the history of these Jewish communities.
It has become, especially in the last years, in some cases, an important aspect of their narrative and of their memory, if not of their history. From a historical point of view, the vast majority, of course, of the Jews of North Africa and of the Middle East did not experience the Holocaust. The only North African Jews that experienced the Holocaust directly were either Jews from North Africa that were living in Europe before when the Second World War broke out, for example, in France, but also Italy, and therefore were deported from Europe as the rest of the Jews that lived in Europe, or small components of, for example, the Jews from Libya. In the case of Libya, we have a few hundred Libyan Jews that were deported from Benghazi to Bergen-Belsen. Then there were a number of North African Jews that were interned in prison camps or labor camps in the Maghreb itself, Tunisia, in Egypt, in Morocco, and in Libya as well. There was, in a way, a connection, if not with the Holocaust, with the Second World War. For example, the Jews of Tunisia were for about 6 months under direct Nazi occupation during the Second World War, the only country in North Africa. Or the Jews of, for example, Algeria, that had been French citizens since 1870, when the Vichy regime began and promulgated the anti-Jewish laws, were stripped of French citizenship, and therefore even those who were still living in Algeria had this traumatic experience of not being French citizens anymore. Numerous clauses was introduced for universities and certain professions and so on. So there were, in some cases, anti-Jewish measures that depended, for example, to Vichy France, as I just said. But apart from that, what we see today is the assimilation, in some cases, to the Holocaust, the assimilation of events, of episodes of anti-Jewish violence that occurred in the 40s and 50s or 60s, like, for example, the 1967 anti-Jewish riots of Benghazi and Tripoli, or the 1948 anti-Jewish riots of Cairo, connecting all that to the Holocaust and by, for example, the press or members of certain North African Jewish associations, remembering all that as part of a North African or Mizrahi, Middle Eastern Jewish Holocaust. And this is, of course, historically speaking, inaccurate, but it relates very much to the centrality that the Holocaust has acquired in Israeli national identity on one side. So when in this case, we're talking about those who live in Israel, but even for those who live in the diaspora, again, the centrality of the Holocaust as an unavoidable category of Jewish history and memory. So even those Jews who did not experience the Holocaust are in a way almost obliged, one could say, to address this issue and also therefore try to come to terms with different episodes of anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish violence through the filter of the Holocaust that has become a kind of blueprint for many other experiences of violence, of genocide, even beyond the Jewish case. Now, even when we talk about, for example, the Rwandan genocide, now, this is something that many scholars have also addressed, this multidirectionality of Holocaust memory, as Michael Rothberg has called it. And so the Holocaust, in the book I talk about, for example, movies that address the issue of Holocaust in North Africa. I talk about a movie on Tunisian Jews in the 1940s, and then about the case of Libya, and a writer that published a book, Yossi Sukari, that is a book that is called Benghazi, Bergen-Belsen, that is a novel based on his grandmother experience in Bergen-Belsen. Important in a, it was important for me to address also this aspect in my study, to understand again not if and how the Holocaust impacted of these communities, as the answer to that is quite simple. It had a rather small impact, or at least only for some, for parts of these communities. But nonetheless, what I wanted to show is the importance that the memory, as I said, more than the history of this event has acquired, and how it has been re-narrated in different ways in the present.
I have a couple more questions, and one perhaps has a very easy answer, but I was curious about the title of this chapter, which is Unfinished Present. Why unfinished?
It is unfinished because, as I write, if we look at the Jews of North Africa, the Jews of the Arab world, we can, if we look at them today, we can see that of course, their past, as the word says, has passed. But at the same time, as a historian that worked on Vichy France entitled his book, it is a past that does not pass. So the past has passed, but at the same time, is still very much present in their lives, and also in that of the following generations. But on the other hand, the future, at least the future that the first generation had envisioned when before they migrated, so when they were still living in their countries of birth, that future never materialized because they left Egypt for Israel, they left Morocco for France, and so on. So this future always remains a kind of hope for something that we know it's very unlikely to ever materialize. So between this past that does not pass and this future that never arrives, what remains, I argue, is a kind of eternal present that continues, I don't want to say forever, but that continues at least for today. And this is something very specific to these communities, but also something that it very much involves all of us. To mention another French historian, François Hartog, has called a very famous book of him, Régime d'Historicité. In this book, he talks about this presentism that in which we all live. So this obsession for the past, this obsession for the future, this nostalgia for a past that perhaps almost certainly was not as we remember. And then what remains again is this present in which we live in that has become the only dimension through which we look at both future and past. Again, just one last thing, if we go back to the Holocaust and how, for example, experiences of anti-Jewish violence is re-narrated through the Holocaust, it's being done from this presentist perspective and not in a more historical point of view. We look at, which is of course obvious, as we cannot look at the past if not through the present, but still it's a very interesting thing to underline.
One more question. Is there anything that we didn't discuss throughout the interview, but that you would like to highlight or point out?
Well, perhaps just one very last thing that I partly already mentioned before is that to me, perhaps more than my previous book on the Jews of Egypt, writing, but even more than writing, conducting research for this book, collecting sources, but especially meeting people and talking to people, visiting museums, taking part in the activities of heritage associations in Paris or Tel Aviv, really was a very emotional experience. And I really, first of all, I met many interesting people. I made new friends, but also it was a very moving experience that allowed me to understand the beauty in a way. Now, I don't want to end in a nostalgic way, but nonetheless, it allowed me to see really the beauty of this North Africa and of this Middle East that for sure, in part, we have lost. And the beauty of the Sephardi Mediterranean that has perhaps vanished. And the end of the book tries to say that perhaps, yes, it has vanished, but maybe in different ways it can return, in new ways it can return. So the Sephardi Mediterranean that the Jews of Egypt and North Africa remember has disappeared, but this doesn't mean that their historical experience, that their memory cannot be helpful for constructing a more harmonious and less divisive Mediterranean even today.
This was Dario Miccoli, author of A Sephardi Sea, Jewish Memories Across the Modern Mediterranean, published by Indiana University Press in 2022, available paperback, ebook, and hardcover. Dario, thank you so much.
Thank you.